Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features session audio from the EDUCAUSE 2013 annual meeting. You can find more audio and video by searching for EDUCAUSE on YouTube and iTunes.
Winston Churchill once said about a political rival, "He was a modest man with much to be modest about." And in your company, and I'm talking about here, physically present, as well as those of you who are joining us virtually from afar, I truly have much to be modest about, because I know from spending time with all of you that the depth and breadth of talent, insight, passion, and commitment is extraordinary. And you've enriched my life beyond all measure. So I'll try to be equal to that glowing introduction. And I'll try to bring you along with me as we take a little journey through close encounters of the fourth kind, where we try to lay bare the questions as part of this process this morning of getting together. That quote comes from James Baldwin. "The purpose of art is to lay bare the questions that have been hidden by the answers." The purpose of art is to lay bare the questions that have been hidden by the answers. My brother-in-law once said, "Hoag, the only thing worse than a hopeless romantic is, in fact, a hopeful one." And I'm afraid that's my category. I am a hopeful romantic about higher education, about colleges and universities, about what it means to be human in the 21st century. And I hope you'll take a journey with me today of hopeful romanticism. As we come together today, I want to talk about aliens and liars, dreamers and schemers. I want to put some fabric around what we do every day and try to weave something together. Talk about context, talk about beliefs. I believe we have to have beliefs. I want to talk a little bit about stuff some spiritual guides have helped me to see. Some of you in the audience have been spiritual guides for me. I want to talk about the challenge of imagining a world that we ourselves will not inhabit. In essence, I want to offer a love letter to higher education, which has been my home now for well over three decades. Stephen Colbert, he's a big old alien. We're going to be talking about aliens a lot, and I don't mean that in any sense of the word as pejorative, as you'll soon see. He grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. I mention that because I am a South Carolinian, quite proud of it. He grew up in a university family. For those of you who know a little bit about Stephen Colbert's history, his father was a provost at the Medical University of South Carolina, and his father and a brother died tragically in a plane accident when Stephen Colbert was a young boy. My colleague Helen Chu from University of Oregon, reminds me about Colbert that we serve what we love. Service is love made visible. And I see so many of you here, and I know so many of you back home in South Carolina. Big shout out to the Gamecocks in the crowd in UTS, the auditorium, that service is love made visible. And every day I must ask myself, and I would submit that you must ask yourselves as well, what am I serving? And I recommend to you that you take a look at Colbert's Northwestern University commencement address that he delivered in 2011. Go to about the 15-minute and 24-second mark, to be precise, and you'll hear some awesome remarks about what it means to serve. Now, not everybody loves colleges and universities. William F. Buckley, the late William F. Buckley, "I'd rather be governed by the first 2,000 people in the Boston telephone directory than by the entire faculty of Harvard University." To which Harvard would reply, if they deigned to reply at all. The poor boy was forced to attend Yale now, wasn't he? Shame he's never gotten over it. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, we all know about that because of the famous movie. It's when sightings of occupants occur in and around a UFO. Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind are a bit rarer, and witnesses experience transformations in their sense of reality, including absurd, hallucinatory, and dreamlike events. Now, if that doesn't define a day in my university life, I don't know what does. Absurdity, hallucinations, dreamlike events are all too common, but I love it. And we know that it's true. So there's this famous university in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that rests right on Massachusetts Avenue. And back in the day when the university, the institute actually, was being founded, they had rather traditional architecture, but that was before the aliens took over. The aliens, once they took over, decided that students ought to live in this building. Their conception of what a student was obviously artificial. And they decided that they would teach computer science and electrical engineering, which they renamed Course 6, much like consuming mass quantities, for those of you who remember the Coneheads. And this is where they have music played and symphonies conducted. And this is where they encourage people to worship. And this is one of their logos. If that's not an alien creation, I don't know what is. I almost subtitled my presentation, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Wishes, Lies, and Dreams. And I repeated dreams twice, quite intentionally, because I think we live on dreams. We live in a world of information technology, yes, but if we don't also live in a world of dreams, then what good is our information technology anyway? Memories, Dreams, Reflections is a book written by Carl Jung. Perhaps some of you know about Carl Jung. He's not in fashion right now, but he'll be back because he's an alien. And Carl Jung was initially a disciple of Sigmund Freud, also out of fashion these days, but he'll be back because he was a big old alien. Time magazine, back when there were such things as magazines that people paid attention to, put Carl Jung on its cover and said he was challenging Freud because he was talking about the soul of all things. Carl Jung smiled and smiled and grew more and more mellow as he aged and he lived in his dreams, his memories, and his reflections. He brought us archetypes and mandalas. Archetypes are inherited through the unconscious. There are certain traits, he believed, that come down through the generations and shape our behaviors. And mandalas are a combination of Buddhist and Hindu symbols that help us to focus on tranquility and to meditate. And he gave us this gem. Everything that irritates us about others can lead us to a greater understanding of ourselves. I need to remember that on Monday when I go back to work. Wishes, Lies, and Dreams. Here's another alien, Kenneth Koch. He was my poetry teacher when I was a freshman at Columbia University in 1969. I was 17 years old and was into hero worship. And Kenneth Koch was ripe for the picking. And one of the things that he's most remembered for is his work with school children to help introduce them to the concept of appreciating poetry and, in fact, writing poetry. And one of my favorite lines from one of his young students who was in elementary school is from Argentina Wilkinson. I wish planes had motors that went rum, bang, zingo, and would be streaming green as the sea. He had to be an alien to help a child dream and wish and lie. and create planes that had motors that went rum, bang, zingo and streamed green as the sea. I was at Columbia University from 1969 to 1970 as a 17-year-old freshman. I'm remarking on this because I know we spend a lot of time now in higher education worrying about the freshman experience, wanting to make sure that our freshmen feel welcomed, warm, comforted, engaged. We want to retain them. Well, it wasn't quite like that in 1969 at Columbia University. As a matter of fact, it was downright hostile. Mark Rudd, there's a name from the past. He was a big old alien. This was what happened when people tried to get into Kenneth Koch's poetry class. There was a tremendous clash. There were more people who wanted to read poetry and sit at his feet than could possibly be accommodated, and a brawl broke out. And this poor fellow, welcome to your freshman year. Eric Holder, coincidentally, was my classmate at Columbia University. So those of you who wonder about Mr. Holder, just remember those prior pictures. He went through that with us in 1969. And I've wondered ever since, particularly in the last couple of months, whether I ever did anything to annoy him, because it seems that he's listening to my phone conversations and reading my email. So the moral of the story is he graduated from Columbia and he went on to join the U.S. Senate. I dropped out of Columbia and I joined the USC cabinet. So U.S. cabinet, USC cabinet. Was it worth it? For me, absolutely. For him, I can't listen to his phone calls or read his email, so I don't know. Eric, hello. So when I dropped out, I actually dropped out twice, and let me tell you, you are in the presence of somebody who is the elite of the elite. Not only did I go to Columbia, but they had at that time a 96% graduation rate. I was in the 4%. My parents were so proud. So I dropped out of Columbia because I needed to write a novel, and goodness knows you can't write a good novel in New York City. So I had to go elsewhere. I went to San Francisco. That's a story for another time, the summer of love. My wife is in the audience, so. But I realized that I had to make some money somehow. So I went to Macy's on 34th Street. Perhaps some of you recall the movie, A Miracle on 34th Street. Macy's and Herald Square. That's where I went to work. And I created my own little miracle at Macy's on 34th Street because I was hired as a stock boy in the bra and girdle department. And I spent hours dressing mannequins. And then I would undress them so I could dress them again, practicing my technique, as it were. I'm afraid that's rather personal and reveals that I didn't have much of a social life at that time. So time fast-forwarded. That didn't seem to be a career that was going to take me very far, and it didn't help my romantic life either. And so being a child of the 60s and being a freshman at Columbia University during all of the rioting, I did the only sensible thing I possibly could. I joined the Army. And I was stationed first at Fort Dix, New Jersey for basic training, and then Fort Jackson, South Carolina, where began my love affair with South Carolina, because I do love South Carolina. And then in summer of 1973, I was sent to Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland. And it turns out that what I thought was a cool gig, because they paid me $50 extra a month. That works out to about $1.60 extra a day, which was serious money back then for somebody who was of my modest means. Turns out that over that 20-year period from 55 to 75, the U.S. Army in conjunction with the CIA and a couple of other alphabet soup agencies, decided that they were going to test out various agents on about 7,000 of us. So again, 4% elite at Columbia, 7,000 out of millions of men who went through the Army. I got lucky. There I am. I'm on the second step, far right. I've got the 1,000-yard stare and a rather cheesy-looking mustache, I must admit. And this was taken at the end of a summer of being experimented on. We were a little raggedy by then. Look at the dude in the front row on the far left. He's saying, "Bring it on. Bring it on." And the guy in the back row on the far left, he's still coming down. He's got the goofiest grin I've ever seen. They tested about 250 substances on us, including nerve agents, mustard agents, nerve agent antidotes. I mean, if they're going to give us nerve agents, you got to give them an antidote. Reactivators, just in case after the antidote you want to put them back under again. Oh, now this part was excellent, because I was what was known as an astronaut. In Army parlance, that means that they liked the top 25% based on physical capability, fitness, and intellectual capability. They peeled off the top 25% and really worked us, because they figured if they could break the top 25%, they were onto something. Riot control agents, they could have used that at Columbia, I have to tell you. Alcohol and caffeine, that one has stayed with me for a long time. So what did I learn all of this? You got to trust but verify. I'm a patriot. I love my country. I'm very proud of being a veteran. But I should have trusted but verified what they were doing to me. But I was a happy fellow. About 2 days before I got out of the Army, I was feeling rather mellow. A favorite dean recently said, back in Columbia, South Carolina, "You know, Bill, you do wander around. And you're probably wondering when I'm going to get to the point." Remember, this is a love letter, and those are not linear. Peter Drucker, who's somebody that you ought to know if you don't, says effectiveness must be learned. Drucker was a 20th century titan. Business Week said he invented management. There's a whole bunch of people who would argue that. But he certainly was a titan. And you can read these for yourself, but I'll just pick out a few of them for those of you who are in the back or out in the virtual audience having a difficult time reading it. "We are now accepting the fact that learning is a lifelong process of keeping abreast of change. And the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn." Does that sound familiar? "The most important thing in communication is to hear what isn't being said. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it." I would argue with that, but that's for another time. And besides, he's no longer living, so I can argue all I want and get away with it. He was pretty well known, had spent some time with the president. And I'll close my Peter Drucker point with one of my favorites. "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." So all of those sessions that you're reading about and engaging in here at EDUCAUSE and in other venues, culture eats strategy. If somebody tells you about how to set up a strategic plan and drive it forward, and they don't talk about culture, chances are pretty good that they're missing a major point. So I love poetry. I love poets. Wallace Stevens was a poet. As a young man, he became a lawyer, and he actually rose to vice president and general counsel of an insurance company in Connecticut, and he became one of the United States' most prominent poets in his spare time while working as a senior executive in an insurance company. Talk about being an alien. Who would think of 13 different ways of looking at a blackbird? The fifth way is the following. "I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling, or just after. Jim Collins was an acolyte of Peter Drucker. I had the pleasure of interviewing Jim Collins in a phone interview for EDUCAUSE. He was a speaker here at an EDUCAUSE conference. You know Jim Collins, good to great. And one of the things that he said in the phone interview to me that really stuck with me is, make absolutely certain you have young people in your face. When an answer isn't satisfactory, young people want to know why. And they create new answers by laying bare the questions that have been hidden by my answers. That's sometimes what we call progress. So my grandson will soon ask why. He is the young person in my face. And that's why I encourage all of you to lay bare those questions for the young people who are coming into our world right now. So a little quick tour of some aliens, maybe they're aliens, that I have known over the years. Patricia Graham was a dean at Harvard University, and she said in a capstone course, we asked her, what's the key to great leadership? What's the key to being a successful leader in a major university as a dean, head of a school? She said, you have to be firm, you have to be fair, and you have to be consistent. Three words: firm, fair, consistent. She's an alien. Michael Gertouzos was the head of the Laboratory for Computer Science, died tragically young at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was from Greece, and he loved to quote a poetic Greek phrase that said, human beings must have one hand reaching for the stars and the other scrabbling in the dirt. Doc Edgerton was another alien at MIT. There's a place called Edgerton Alley if you ever get a chance to go there. He was also known as Papa Flash because he had a working partnership with Jacques Cousteau and invented all sorts of undersea photography methodologies. Some of these images are iconic. You've seen them before. He learned how to use strobes. He learned how to stop time. He even learned how to take a picture of the first millisecond of the explosion of a nuclear device. That's what's in the upper right-hand corner. Robert Frost said, fire and ice, in his poem, Fire and Ice, some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if I had it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. In case you were wondering, he was an alien. Joel Moses was and is an institute professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And over the years, he developed quite a reputation. There's all sorts of legends at MIT about his intellect and his capacity for dealing with difficult issues. And I had worked at MIT in the mid-1980s and got to know him during that time. And then I went away for a period of time. And then I came back to MIT again in a different capacity. And we met one day, he walking from this direction and I from this, on the infinite corridor. Where else but MIT would there be an infinite corridor? Hi, Joel. Bill Hoag, Project Athena. He stopped and he peered at me. Yes, of course. I know you. I haven't seen you lately. What have you been doing? I've been away for 8 years. Ah, but you're back. Yes, I am. Yes, I am, Joel. Remarkable. Guy's an alien. Van Hise Hall, I spent a little time at the University of Wisconsin System, a major hub of alien activity. Absolutely. That's Van Hise Hall. You ought to be able to tell it right away because there's nothing in the background to prevent the spaceships at night from flying in undetected over the water. And you can see from the top view that there's landing pads there. Ron Bornstein was my boss during a period when I worked there, and he was the senior vice president for administration. Essentially, he was number two. He was the person who made things happen. And they were trying to recruit me from a job I held elsewhere in the University of Wisconsin system. And I was going to be working with him, and he wanted me to come down and spend the proverbial half time at that job and also keep my full-time gig back at my other campus. And I was having a hard time wrapping my head around that because the trust but verify thing came in. You know, I thought the Army said they were going to give me $50 and I was going to have a good time. And then they started using nerve agents on me. And he's saying, I'm going to have a half-time job here, a half-time job there, and I'll have a good time. It doesn't sound like a real good deal. And I was in his office, and I began to feel this sense of the enormity of the task that he was asking me to take on. He wanted me to set up the first Office of Learning and Information Technology for the University of Wisconsin system. This was in the early 1990s, and they didn't have one yet. And we were looking out the window from the alien headquarters there in Van Hise Hall, overlooking the UW-Madison campus. And I said, Ron, how do you possibly stand the pressure? You've got a $2 billion budget. You have 150,000 students. You have 27,000 faculty and staff. How in heaven's name can you possibly do anything? This is Ron, by the way, clearly an alien. You just look at him and you know he's an alien. And they say that he moved to Arizona because he was tired of snow and cold weather. I'm convinced it's because there's a lot of desert where he could spend time in obscurity communicating with other aliens. And his response was, Bill, I want you to look over here. If you look really hard off in the distance, you can see the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and you can see the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and you can see Oshkosh and Stevens Point and Parkside and Baraboo. Isn't that a nice name? Baraboo. And Bill, as I look out on this vast University of Wisconsin system and the hundreds of thousands of people who are part of this system, I know in my heart that even as we're talking here, somebody, somewhere, is screwing up. And if you can't accept that, you shouldn't try to sit in my chair. At that moment, another alien came in from a hidden side door that connected to his office, and it was Catherine Lyle, the president of the University of Wisconsin system. He must have telepathically summoned her in because she walked up to me. She was a diminutive woman, and she looked up at me, and she said, we need you, and we thank you for coming to join us. What was I going to do? There was the trust. There was the verification. Of course, she took me around the bend, but that was okay. I really liked her a lot. And the thank you part was absolutely marvelous. At the end of the 6 months that they said we were going to be staying there, turned into a year and a half, at the end of that, she personally invited my wife and I to come to her personal home, and she personally cooked us a meal and spent the evening with us. I'll remember it forever. Larry Snack was my chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He liked to introduce himself to people as just a simple Iowa farm boy. And he used to say to the people who reported to him that it's 20 below zero today, and that's without the wind chill. And the dairy farmer in Cadott, Wisconsin, got up to milk the cows at 4 o'clock this morning. He expects you to take care of his children and take care of his money, because he gives money every day to make this great University of Wisconsin system operate. And you have to be able to look that farmer from Cadott in the eye and say, yes, sir, I have, and I will. More aliens, a whole cluster of aliens, Sherry Turkle, Seymour Papert, and Steve Jobs. Sherry Turkle, Seymour Papert, and Steve Jobs. This was about 1986. I was at MIT. No question, these were mega aliens. An invitation came to a reception. I'll tell you about that in a minute. First, in case you're not familiar, Sherry Turkle first came to public light, really, in 1984 when she published a book called The Second Self, Computers and the Human Spirit. She was thinking about that, these issues of the human spirit and computers back in 1984, a long time ago. Papert, well, all he did was co-found MIT's Artificial Intelligence Lab and the Media Lab. His laboratory invented Logo, the computer language for children, and he wrote the book, Mindstorms, Children, Computers, and Powerful Ideas. To top it off, they were married. And the reception that they were hosting was for Steve Jobs, and you sort of know about him. He's the guy who said, I'm going to put a dent in the universe. There were two much more senior people than me who got invited to come to this reception, but it trickled down to me because they were both busy. And Susan and I ended up going to this beautiful brownstone in the Back Bay of Boston, totally intimidated. I was in my early 30s, had no business being there, had no idea what I was doing. And we open the door, and somebody takes our coats because we didn't have a whole lot of money. And the person who was picking up coats as people came in was used to cashmere, and mine was not quite cashmere. So Sherry Turkle, Seymour Papert, and Steve Jobs were all sitting around the living room with about 25 other people, and we were among those 25 other people, arguing about how they were going to invent the future of computing. That was about 27 years ago. Aliens, clearly aliens. At the time, Susan was the personal photographer at Harvard University for the great psychologist B.F. Skinner. And whether you like him or not, he helped shape our conception of self, and that's a mighty achievement. He had some provocative ideas. Can we afford freedom? And he was talking about these things 25 years ago, and we're still talking about them, and there's still a question every day about the nature of freedom, the nature of technology, the nature of human control of other humans, and about the nature of our ability to apply our imagination as free human beings. Howard Gardner was one of my professors in my graduate program at Harvard University and had at one time been a disciple of B.F. Skinner, had a falling out, and moved away from behaviorism and instead began developing a theory of multiple intelligences that suggested you cannot reduce any of us to a single number. And in fact, there's so much to appreciate about everyone that that's the way we ought to approach every person that we meet. And I watched a rather unfair fight between a then elderly B.F. Skinner and a young Howard Skinner. Excuse me, that's a good Freudian slip. Speaking of Freud, the aliens are beginning to descend on me. Howard Gardner and B.F. Skinner talking about the nature of human intelligence and how it could apply to all of us as we went forward. Not a fair fight, but one that was clearly me being invited to witness aliens who transform our sense of what's real. What is reality? Vint Cerf is a familiar name, perhaps. I first met Vint through an EDUCAUSE event at Snowmass a long time ago, and then he came to the University of South Carolina to talk to us as well. You may recall that he is the one of three people credited with inventing the Internet. He and his team put together TCP/IP, the transport mechanism for all of our network traffic, for better or for worse. Charming guy, but clearly an alien. And when I last saw him, as he was departing Columbia, South Carolina for the rest of his activities in the week ahead, I said, "Where next? What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I think I'm going to go talk to some people at NASA about inventing the intergalactic internet." An alien for sure. Paul Sappho, a futurist and an observer of all things technology at Stanford University, has a wonderful saying that I like to quote frequently: "Never mistake a clear vision for a short distance." It's like this every day at the University of South Carolina. If you would like to come and visit, I hope you will. There's actually some aliens there, but so far they haven't transformed the place into anything inhospitable, and we would love to host you. So as you leave this hall, or wherever you may be watching, extend your hand in welcome to someone nearby. It can be someone at your table. It can be someone in the auditorium at the University of South Carolina. It can be someone in the hall or walking down the street in a line waiting for your flight home. And in the days and the weeks and the months ahead, I urge you to lay bare the questions. We in IT must do more than look at IT. We must ask the questions that have been hidden by the answers. Serve what you love, and please, please, please stay in touch. You've been very gracious. I thank you. I wish you safe journey.